This is HPR episode 2384 entitled, Slackware in Scotland. It is hosted by Andrew Conway and is about 57 minutes long and carries a clean flag. The summary is, Binny comes to Scotland and talks to Andrew about Slackware 14.2 a year after release.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hello HPR listeners, it's Andrew Conway here, also known as McNallu, and I'm joined by a special guest.
Yeah, here is Benny from Switzerland. You probably don't know me because I only record like one episode a year, but yes, I'm back again.
Yes, and you're known online in various places as Navigium.
Yes. Yeah, so. Yeah, it is. A name I just randomly picked from a Latin dictionary.
What does it mean?
I think it means boat.
Boat?
I'm not sure. It was back when I started university, I had to do a course in Latin because before I studied math, I started with philosophy. And then I had just this Latin dictionary lying around and I had to figure out the handle. I just opened a random page, pointed at a random word, and ended up to be Navigium.
That could have been a lot worse.
Yeah, well, not true.
There's plenty of unpleasant body parts, for example, that have Latin names that you want to avoid.
I don't know whether they are just in a regular Latin dictionary, no one made for medicine.
Yes, a medical dictionary would be one to avoid. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we're not here to talk to you about Latin. As I mentioned, that Benny is sat here right next to me. And previously we recorded an episode for HPR about Slackware. But that time you were in Switzerland and I was here in Scotland. Yeah. And now we're both here in Scotland because you've been travelling around on a bike.
Yeah. Well, on a bicycle. On a pedal bike.
Pedal bike, yes.
I do like motorbikes, but this time I didn't. It's not that easy to pack for a flight.
That's true. Yes, I can imagine you'd have to bike a long way to get to Scotland from Switzerland. Anyway, so what we're going to talk about is more Slackware stuff, and it's a little bit out of date because we've just been discussing when the last version of Slackware came out, and it was actually almost exactly a year ago. In fact, just over a year ago, 1st of July 2016.
Exactly. But, I mean, in Slackware time, this is just recently, right?
Exactly, yes. You have to think geological timescales. If you're an Arch Linux user, you are to Slackware what maybe a fruit fly is to an elephant.
More or less.
Like, you live in a different time scale. So the other thing is, I have to confess that I only installed Slackware 14.2. I've only gone from 14.1 to 14.2 in this last week, mainly because Benny told me he was coming, and I was hoping that we would do this, and I thought it might be an idea to actually install it before we discussed it.
usually it's good to know what you talk about. I actually installed it right when it came out because I went on holiday. I went cycling, obviously, last summer too, in Iceland. And I brought my laptop and I thought it would be a good idea to just upgrade to Slackware 14.2 before I go there. Because it's Slackware, so you just upgrade and everything works. It's not like with Arch Linux, you just wait until after the holiday because it breaks everything.
Well, maybe I haven't. Yeah, I can't comment on that. But Arch users, I'm sure, will understand it. I
used Arch Linux only for like 1 year or something, and it kind of broke monthly. But
yeah, I tried to run a server for reasons that best known to myself with Arch, and it broke straight away because a broken Perl package. It happened to enter in that very night that I installed it. But by the next day, it was working again. To be fair, but.
We'll get a lot of comments on this episode by Arch users,
yes,
I'm sure.
Yes.
Yeah, that's fine. You're the fruit fly, remember.
Yeah, indeed. The reason I didn't install it back on the 1st of July 2016, I think I was already on holiday and I probably didn't have all that great internet. And also, I think it was a very busy time for me. So I had a stable laptop that was working. I was just going to go with that, even when I got back from holiday. And I didn't really have any reason to upgrade. Actually, recently I have, because Firefox in 14.1, which was a extended service release edition of Firefox, the Google applications were not supported on it anymore. And there were problems attaching files through the browser.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, so... that was one indication that I was using quite out-of-date software, to be honest. So it was high time that I got with it. Anyway, so I am now, at least in Slackware timescales, with it. Only a year behind. So I guess the first thing to say is, in my case anyway, the installation was as boring as could be. It was dead easy. I just did a fresh install. I didn't actually upgrade it. I did a fresh install, and nothing exciting happened, and nothing difficult happened. What was your...
Yeah, I think it was about the same. I mean, it was 1 year ago, so I don't exactly remember the details, but basically, I think I also did a fresh install. I didn't upgrade. I think on the laptop, I did a fresh install, and on the desktop, I just moved from Slackware Current to Slackware Stable, which basically means when Current hits 14.2, I just stop following Current, and everything works anyway because it did before, so it's not going to change anything.
Yeah, because it's quite an overnight change to go from the last Slackware Current to the new release Slackware. Would be just a few packages, really, and
I think in this case it wasn't even anything, which is an entry in the changelog that says that's now 14.2.
Oh, right.
And there are like disk images to download, but if you're already in Current, you were already on Slackware 14.2 the day before.
Yes, okay, so it was basically highly unexciting. The other thing I would add is that I couldn't get the USB stick method to work. I was supposed to use an ISO hybrid, and I DD'd the ISO hybrid ISO image onto a memory stick, and it didn't work, so I just burnt a DVD instead. But that was a very minor inconvenience. Yeah,
but, well, it could well be the USB stick that was faulty.
Yeah, so...
I think I did one install from a USB stick, and it all worked.
Yes, it could be, right. Could be the USB stick. Although, what I can tell you is, from putting the DVD into the machine to sitting at the login prompt of the fully installed and operational Slackware 14.2 operating system took 21 minutes and 7 seconds. So it was pretty fast, and that includes time I would have spent reading some documentation along the way, because Slackware does reward actually reading some documents, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. You do read the readmes, you don't just launch in. I don't think there was anything particularly interesting in the readmes, to be honest, but I thought I'd better read them anyway, just in case something... For contrast, at the same time, my son's PC upstairs was getting a Windows 10 update that took the best part of 2 entire days to do, during which time he couldn't play any of his games. So there you go.
Yeah.
You want to do Windows 10? Go right ahead.
Yeah. I usually do a full disk encryption install, so I have to read the README file anyway, because it's not that straightforward to do a full disk encryption, as in you just click in the install or do a full disk encryption, but the README file is quite good. So you just walk through the README file and everything works.
Yeah, but, so I've not tried that yet. I need to, that's something I need to, I really should do, but as my laptop rarely leaves my desk, I'm not too that worried about it. But I should still do it as a matter of principle.
Yeah. I do have a full disk encryption on every machine, even on the desktop. Just don't know why.
Yeah. No, that's a sensible thing to do.
It's also good when you have to discard a hard drive. You don't have to delete like the whole drive for several times and overwrite with zeros and random data, because it's all random data anyway.
That's true. Yeah. Actually, I sat on the front doorstep recently with I was cleaning up my parents' house, and I forget how many PCs there were, but I had something like 30 hard drives that I'd extracted from the PCs. I'd extracted all the data off them, and I just sat with a hammer smashing them to pieces. They're surprisingly hard to smash to pieces, some of them.
I heard a drill is quite effective. Just drill holes.
Drill holes into
the hard drive.
Yeah. Not as much fun as smashing it with a hammer.
Yeah, definitely not.
Anyway.
You could also look for high buildings and throw them off the roof. That's what the IT department in our school usually does with servers.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Goodness, during school holidays.
Yeah, you have to make sure there's nobody stood underneath.
Yeah.
Yes. So, anyway, back to Slackware. So,
one question about the install I was about to ask is, what did you use? Did you legacy BIOS mode or UEFI?
Legacy BIOS mode. Right. Yeah, there was no particularly good reason for that, other than my laptop was set up that way. It's a Dell XPS 13 that came with Ubuntu, and that is how it was set up when it came. But don't ask me why Dell did it that way. So I just carried on doing it the same way that Dell had set it up with Ubuntu.
I
resized the partitions. I did do that, but so you could interpret that as an admission of laziness on my part.
Well, I did both, because on the Chromebook I use, I replaced the firmware, the core boot firmware. With an image that contains CBIOS, so it's legacy BIOS anyway. There is no UEFI, and this worked as you'd expect. And the UEFI one worked also out of the box, but you have to install Slackware is still on Lilo.
Yes.
Lilo.
I call it Lilo.
Lilo. And there is eLilo, which does UEFI.
Yes, that's right.
The installer automatically tells you to use eLilo, and it quite works out of the box. You could also replace it with Grub, which is in the extras, no?
I think it is. Yeah, you can use Grub.
I think it is, yeah.
I don't know if I've ever used it with Slackware. But
me neither.
Yeah. But initially, I did have Grub on this laptop, because, of course, that's what it came with. And I did set it up to boot Slackware from Grub. That did work. But then I just know Lilo much better than Grub. So at some point I just stopped using Grub and used Lilo, just because I know it better. No particularly good reason. So I guess we should also say what changed in Slackware. And there's actually been some interesting changes. Not that I really know it from the installation as a user, but if you sort of look under the lid, there have been a few changes, haven't there?
Yeah, well, not too many. As you said, there were basically no changes that you'd notice as an end user. It's a few new versions of software, but nothing dramatically different.
No, Firefox would work with Google applications without complaining.
For example, I think KDE is still KDE4, right? I'm not using KDE, but I think
This is being recorded, and it looks like KDE4. Like,
yeah, I think there are packages of KDE5 around. I tried it once on Slackware Current. I think it looks quite okay, but I've never been a KDE person.
Yeah, well, I don't really use much of KDE, but I just it's the default, and you know, I'm quite happy with it. Know my way around it. So again, not that fussed, to be honest. Yeah. As long as it works and lets me do what I want to do, don't really care what desktop I'm using.
Yeah, I think most of the changes have to do with, as probably everyone is still Everyone is aware that Slackware still uses like RC script and no systemd to boot. And some of the changes are just like workarounds to avoid systemd. One of them is they had to replace UDEF with EUDEF, which is, to my knowledge, developed by Gentoo, which also does, they boot with OpenRC, which is also something different than systemd. Slackware doesn't use OpenRC or anything. They just use plain BSD RC script. That's to my knowledge.
Yes, that's right. I mean, you've got the same knowledge as I do of EU Dev, which is that it avoids systemd and comes from Gentoo.
That's about all we know about it, but. I thought I'll just mention it, but we can't tell you the difference. I'm not sure whether there is even a difference.
No, I don't. I mean, I think that's sort of the point. Is it supposed to be a drop-in replacement? So,
yeah.
Now, what seems to be good news is that at least so far, I haven't noticed, and I never noticed any applications wanting systemd or even Pulse Audio. On Slackware, except with the one exception, the game VVVVV, I think there's five V's or there's six, I can never remember. It's like a retro platforming game you may have seen. And when I installed that in Slackware, I think it was 14.1, it wanted to see that Pulse Audio was there, but didn't actually ever use it. So I had to install the Pulse Audio package, then I would play the game, and then when I finished playing the game, I'd uninstall the package again. It sounds daft, but you know, it wouldn't work without it.
Yeah, but that was Pulse Audio. That was systemd.
And the point being that I never missed not having Pulse Audio, even though every other Linux distro was using it. And still to this day, I don't think there's any application that will refuse to work without systemd. But you've got a longer experience.
I never tried GNOME 3. I don't know whether GNOME 3 still works without systemd. But I think the Gentoo people do some kind of fork of GNOME that still works without systemd. But...
yeah, well, Slackware dropped GNOME a long time ago, back in the GNOME 2 days. But I'm pretty sure in the release notes it did mention that there's something called Dropline
GNOME. Oh,
that you can still use. So it must still be possible. But I actually don't know anyone in my circle of... very limited circle of fellow Slackers that uses GNOME in Slackware, so I really can't comment. And I've never tried to use it. I've never been that fussed about GNOME and like can't be bothered going to the effort of installing it in Slackware. But I think it is feasible. It's still doable.
But this leads us back to the second big change is Pulse Audio now comes with Slackware 14.2.
That's right, yes. And so it is there, so I hopefully don't have to install it every time I want to play VVVVV.
Yeah.
That's one small advantage. But what was the reason that they put Pulse Audio in?
Apparently there was a Bluetooth library which wasn't supported anymore without Pulse Audio, so they had to either stop using Bluetooth at all in Slackware or include Pulse Audio.
Right.
So in this case, it was just a sensible decision. I mean, you can't have an operating system that doesn't support Bluetooth on devices that do have like a Bluetooth port.
Yeah. I still have to confess, I've never really used Bluetooth. Although I noticed when I started up Slackware 14.2, I'm using KDE. I haven't changed any settings. I bizarrely have two Bluetooth applications in my toolbar. You know, the little bit, whatever you call that little bit to the left of the clock where sort of little indications of running applications are left for you. But two Bluetooth icons.
Yeah, I think the one is an applet, like the Blue Man applet or something, and the other one is the one that comes with KD.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I actually wouldn't have missed Bluetooth, I don't think. I use it on my phone a lot. I've never had cause to use it in my laptop yet, but I think I'll try now, given the amount of all this effort. I think I should try.
Yeah, I just sent a file from my laptop to my phone a few days ago. I didn't even know before that my laptop has a Bluetooth port.
Oh.
I just looked at, what's the application called? It's RFKill.
RFKill, yes. Uh-huh.
And it showed me two devices, one Wi-Fi and one Bluetooth. So I figured I'll have Bluetooth. But I didn't have the services, the Bluetooth services enabled. So I needed to enable those to use it. It's also another RC script, rc.bluetooth.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yes, that's right. I actually had to do that.
Yeah.
Now you come to mention it, I did have to transfer a file by Bluetooth on this laptop under Slackware 14.1 to my phone. I did do, yes, you're right. Actually, I have done that once. I know I've done that, even though I said a minute ago that I didn't ever do it, because I, correct me if I'm wrong, Benny, but I did say earlier on it's very slow. So how would I know it was very slow if I'd never done it?
Yeah, true.
So I have done it once.
It
was an APK file that I wanted to put on my phone.
That's exactly what I use it for, yeah. Because I use, on the desktop, I use Raccoon. It's called Raccoon. That's a Java application that helps you download APKs from the Play Store.
Oh, really? And
there are a couple of APKs I use that are not in F-Droid, that are proprietary, obviously. One is the official application of the Swiss Railways, because they sell tickets over this one, and sometimes I'm just too late to get a ticket at the station, so I just sit in a train and hope I'll get a ticket before the train leaves the station, because otherwise you're not allowed to buy a ticket over the app online.
Oh, they keep trying to do that in Scotland, telling you have to have a ticket before you board the train, but they never penalise you for it.
The first time it costs like 100 Swiss francs, which is around, you know, £80.
Yes, I can see it would.
And the second time it costs you even more, and then more again.
Although I think probably it's fair to say that you've also got a generally better train service than we have here. Not that our service is actually, I know that because I've been to Zurich and the trains were like extremely punctual and very clean.
Yeah, yeah, they are. I live in the place where I live on the train line. There, the worst trains in Switzerland. They're almost every fifth train is a few minutes late. And
so minutes, not nanoseconds.
It's even minutes in this case, yeah. And the main reason is that's the train line that leads to Italy. A lot of trains run through Italy and then to Switzerland.
So you're blaming the Italians?
At the station, they always tell you, the train is late. The reason for this is something that happened abroad.
Yeah. Oh, dear. So if there's any Italian Arch Linux listeners, we do apologize for offending you.
Even if you're only Italian.
Or an Arch Linux user.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Forget that one.
Anyway. So it was, overall, you know, despite that fairly big change to the sound system, I have to say that I installed the Audacity package. I think I got it from Slack Bills, stuck it on. I mean, Benny was here, he watched me, opened the application, hit record, had to fiddle a bit with the microphone levels, but, you know, no big deal.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it worked fine. It thinks it's using Alsa.
It looks like, I don't know, maybe there is some layer of Pulse Audio that, like, pretends to be Alsa.
It must be that. Because it did say that, that's what you said, and that's what it said in the notes, but also it is there in its own right, because Pulse Audio is really just a layer. So it's all working fine, you know. As far as I know, we've done a test recording and it was working fine with that.
And this basically leads us to the second topic we plan to talk about, You mentioned Slack builds. You mentioned installed Audacity from a Slack build, and we were going to discuss tools that we use to install things from Slack builds.
Yes.
So maybe you could run me through your way of installing things from Slack builds.
Well, when I first discovered Slack builds, I would download the Slack build, then go and download the source tarball and just run the Slack build. Maybe I'll read it first and then run it.
Maybe we should tell people what Slack
builds are.
I mean, if you know FreeBSD ports or package source and NetBSD, or for Arch users, the user archives, it's about the same. It's just like a collection of build scripts that help you build a package for your operating system, in this case Slackware.
Yeah, so you can install. Indeed. There's no binary package that you download. What you download a tiny tarball that contains the Slack build script and some other metadata files. And then it's up to you to go and get the original source tarball. And in most cases, it just compiles it and creates a Slackware package and you install it, nothing else to it.
Yeah.
A few cases, you might want to go into the Slack build script and set some compile options. And in a few cases, there are patches that get applied along the way. But that is a sort of part of the Slackware philosophy, is that you don't really use patches unless there's a very good reason to. And I think Slack builds aims to follow Patrick Volkerding's approach. And he invented Slack builds, obviously. So with that...
Did he?
Yes, I think so. Yes, that's how Slackware packages are
built. Oh, yeah, that's how... He didn't like slackbuilds.org.
No,
like
that wasn't the platform. No. But the concept of a Slack build script was just...
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know if he even called them Slack build scripts originally.
He just used build scripts to build packages.
Yeah, but...
I mean, after all, it's just like basically a shell script that builds a package.
Yeah, that's all it is. Yeah, it's just a shell script. Yeah, it's exactly what it is. Anyway, so that's the background. So rather than, you know, doing lots of clicking around in your browser, you can go in the command line. So I would usually log on su to root, and then run this application called sbopkg, sbo package. It's very easy to configure. And then it's got a kind of curses semi-graphical user interface, but I quite like curses interfaces, so I'm quite happy with that. And you can search all the different scripts that are on the Slack builds site. And I think it downloads a mini archive cache onto your machine, so it doesn't have to go and talk to Slack builds every so often, but you have to sync it with the Slack build site. And then I search for the package I want, maybe read a little bit about it. There's an info option which will tell you which dependencies it might have. And very often there are no dependencies, and in some cases there'll be a few dependencies. Very often, again, I'll have already got those because I've installed other packages. And if I haven't, then I have to then add those to the queue, the dependency packages, and then I say execute the queue, downloads it, compiles it, installs it.
Yeah.
And very rarely is there a problem. Maybe occasionally an MD5 some doesn't check out or something like that.
Yeah, true.
But that's not Slack build's fault. Well, I don't know whose fault that is, but it does happen, but it's pretty rare. I think it's actually usually it's at the upstream, whoever provides the source code, they maybe package things up in an automated or slightly unusual way. That breaks the Slack build's way of doing things. Maybe that. So I don't know though. Yeah. But anyway, so that's my modus operandi.
Dependencies are usually mentioned in the README file, that also explains. I mean, the README file, basically you don't just install a Slack build without reading the README file, because it always contains useful information. It contains variables you could set to kind of change the way the Slack build works. A lot of Python packages need the variable Python 3 equals yes to build with Python 3 instead of Python 2. And sometimes you need to add, you need to run a few commands before you install the Slack build. For example, demons that use special users or special groups they run under, you need to create the groups, and you need
That's true,
doesn't just like happen in the background. That usually you have to create those, because that's also a bit Slackware philosophy. You want to know what you did. You just, there is no magic behind the whole packaging system. Like,
that's true. Yes, if something goes wrong, it shouldn't be too much of a surprise to you, because at some point you did it.
Yeah, yeah. Usually, whenever a Slack build doesn't build, not always, but often, I just realize I didn't read the README close enough, and I overread something that I should have paid close attention to.
Yeah.
And then it just doesn't install or doesn't build.
Yeah. It's very rare that I've had problems. Most of the time, yeah, it's definitely annoying when it doesn't work, just because I expect it to work.
Yeah.
But like you say, usually when something's gone wrong, I do feel like it's my fault for not paying attention, not reading the README. Yeah, that's true. Yes, always read the README in Slackware. I've found slackbuilds.org and SBO package really beneficial. There's been a few times when the dependencies, in fact, actually only one time, I think the dependencies really got up my nose. I found it difficult, and that was, and you found that as well, with Pandoc requires Haskell, and Haskell comes in a bit of a zillion little tiny packages that all need to be built. But the solution to that, which I always felt a bit kludgy, was the Q files, which you load up, and that kind of parses, I think it's called info.slackbuild, I can't remember what it's the .info file that comes in the Slack build tarball, and that contains a sort of machine readable or bash script readable set of strings which says these are all the dependencies you need, and the Q files sort of encode that in one big lump.
Is this in the info file? I thought it was only mentioned in the README file.
No, the README file, by convention, was supposed to mention it. But then they added, there's a separate file.
It's in the info,
I think so. I need to double check that.
I'm sure that's true.
But it was put into allow dependency automation, make it more easy. But anyway, so the Q files were an effective solution, and they worked. Although I was always a bit worried that they didn't get synced. It was up to me to download the latest versions of the Q files.
Yeah.
It wasn't automated. They would be synced like the rest of Slack builds. So it always felt like a bit of a...
Yeah. There's a Q file generator you could use.
Oh, is there? All right.
I think it's SQG.
Oh, yes. So there is,
Slackware Q file generator, SQG. Mm-hmm. Yeah, SQG. Yes. And then you just specify what package you want to build the Q file for.
That's right. I forgot about that, yes. Uh-huh.
But that's the main reason why I started using SBO tools instead of SBO PKG. Well, no, basically the main reason is, I have to go back a bit. The reason why I use Slackware is I like to use Open or FreeBSD on my machines, but I use a lot of hardware which isn't supported by either OpenBSD and FreeBSD, especially Wacom pen support.
Ah, right. Uh-huh.
There are no drivers for those, and I use those basically daily for work. Slackware is just the one distribution that feels very much like FreeBSD. And SBO Tools is close to some port installation tools you find on FreeBSD. And basically, you not only get one tool, it's like a tool set of different tools. There is SBO Snap, which is the same as Port Snap on FreeBSD. I think it's called, it's called Port Snap on FreeBSD, which does nothing except download the collection of Slack builds.
Mm-hmm.
you usually run, the first time you run port snap fetch, and then you run port snap update later to get the newest version of the Slack builds. And then there are different scripts like SBO. The most important one is SBO install, which basically just installs the Slack build, but it also parses the info file and the README file and go through all the dependencies and kind of for every dependency asks you whether you want to install this one too. And also if it finds options in the README file, like the one I mentioned before, Python 3 equals yes, then it asks you whether you want to set some options. Also, if it finds a line in the README file that starts with a hash, it assumes that this means it's the root shell hash and that you need to execute something before installing before building the Slack build, then it asks you whether you want to automatically execute these commands. The main point for me is it doesn't do anything in the background automatically. It also always asks you whether, do you want to execute this? Yes, no. Do you want to set variables? Yes, no, and then you set them manually.
And unlike SBO package, it's not curses based.
It's plain. I think it's written in Perl as the equivalent in FreeBSD. I think it's also Perl. But I don't know anything about Perl, but I don't mind it.
You don't need to know any Perl to use it. It's just command line tools.
It's on Slackware. It's there anyway. It's installed anyway. So you don't need to install Perl first because it already comes with Slackware. So I found that this makes life a bit easier without losing control. That's why I prefer SBO tools at the moment.
Yes, no, I can certainly see the attraction of it. And I think one thing I sometimes I do find myself getting a bit annoyed with the curses interface. I think it might be suit me better actually to be just working entirely on the command line. The other application I use to maintain Slackwares, and that you do as well, Benny, is Slack package Slack PKG, and also its plugin Slack package Plus, which allows you to the original Slack package just dealt with official Slackware repositories, which didn't give you very much beyond a fairly big 8 gig original install. It's less than that. It's including the source code, isn't it? 8 gigs. So it's more like 2.5 gig, which is quite a lot of packages. Let's say it comes with Perl, it comes with GCC and Python, and various SVN, Git, and everything. All the basic stuff that I would expect, some weird anachronistic stuff like XV as well. But anyway, the point.
And here, the BSD games.
And
right?
The BSD games, yes, and the. Yes, because we were discussing, what was his name? Claudio Miranda did an HPR recently that I've listened to that you said you were going to listen to about open sourcing the Colossal Cave Adventure game, which I used to play as a young boy in the 70s. It's a good HPR episode, I recommend that. Anyway, that comes with Slackware.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's not the open source version, it's one of the other versions that we may not have the source code for. Or maybe somebody should create a Slack build and submit it to slackbuilds.org for the open source version.
Yeah.
We can compare how it differs to the one in BSD games. Anyway, big digression there. Where did I go? We're talking about using Slack package. So that just says official repositories, and Slack package plus allows you to use other non-official repositories. And the main one I use, which, although technically it's non-official, it's Alien Bob, Eric Hamliers. He's one of the key people in Slackware. If there is a number two guy,
he's the one.
Maybe Robbie Workman. I'm not like... anyway, without doubt, Eric Hamliers has produced a lot of great stuff for Slackware, including... pre-compiled binary packages like tarballs, which you can search and install using /package/+. And that's all in the command line, which suits more my use, like you described, SBO tools. I've not used SBO tools, but it sounds more like that.
Yeah. But to be fair, Slack PKG?
I thought Slack package.
Slack package. It has some cursus interfaces you could use. For example, if you what was the command? Was Slack PKG clean system or clean install or something. Removes all the packages that weren't installed through sources from Slack PKG. And then you get the like cursus interface to select uninstall.
Mm-hmm.
And also on the other side, SBO PK. Is it SBO? No.
SBO PKG. Yeah.
SBO PKG can be used on the command line.
That's completely fair.
So you can do SBO PKG -i and the package name, then it installs.
That slipped my mind. You're absolutely right. Yes. Yes. So So I mean, I think that's covered all the things we wanted to discuss about Slackware. Maybe is there anything else that you wanted to mention?
Yeah, we had one thing that's still open.
Oh.
We plan to talk about how we manage Wi-Fi networks.
Of course, yes. Sorry, yes.
On Slackware, because we both use quite different tools.
Yes.
So maybe again, you go first and you tell us.
Okay. Well, I originally used just the tools that came with Slackware, which is essentially the part of the RC script system. Mm-hmm. But recently, I think it was when I was taking my laptop out and about more than I do now, I wanted a user interface so I could look at more easily at what Wi-Fi stuff was, networks were available, and enter the passwords and all the other fiddly options. So I ended up using Wicked Curses for that. But on my desktop machines, I didn't use it. Wicked is it's not actually an official part of Slackware. It's in the extra bit, so it's like on the DVD or in the download ISO that you get, but it won't be installed by default. You have to go and install it manually.
Mm-hmm. So it's the one that's spelled WICD, right?
WICD. And now Slackware does come now, it didn't used to, but now it comes with Network Manager, which I have tried to use, but I didn't get on with particularly well. I went back to Wicked. But Wicked, so it's a daemon that runs, and like I said earlier, there's a curses interface, so you could use that, or you could use the little sort of app that sits in the system tray. That was the word I was looking for. You. System tray that sits next to the clock. It appears there, just like it would in the Windows or a Mac. You just click it and it opens up and shows you what Wi-Fi networks are present that you can connect to. Although I've had a slight problem with my XPS 13 in that when I put it to sleep and wake it up again, sometimes it doesn't automatically connect to the wired network, which it should do instantly. And then I can't get it to connect by clicking in the little thing in the system tray. But if I go into Wicked Curses in the command line, it connects even without me telling it to. It just doesn't. Yeah. I don't know why that happened. That was in Slackware 14.1. I don't know. I don't think that's happened to me yet in Slackware 14.2. So, so that's how I do it.
What's the reason you don't use Network Manager? Why did you install Wicked instead?
I had some problem. I don't remember, to be honest. But when I went to 14.1, I tried it. And I couldn't configure something the way I wanted it to. It would likely have been, I think, I don't know for sure, but it's possible that it was that when my laptop's in the house, I want it to be static IP when it's connected to the wired network, but I want it to be dynamic when it's connected to the wireless.
All right.
And yeah. I think, yeah. And it could have been my fault, but I think I had some problem setting up a network manager and it kept getting confused. Or I kept getting confused, to be fair. I can't, but I don't honestly remember. It was a while ago. But I already knew Wicked, so I went back to Wicked, and it just worked. I got it very quickly set up exactly the way I wanted. Yeah, so that was it. Yeah, so how do you do things?
Yeah, depends. When I'm, like now, when I'm traveling, I just activate the network manager script and use the... like the tray icon to join wireless networks sometimes, but usually I basically roam between different Wi-Fi networks and they're always the same. So
just one at home and one at work and
one at work, a different cafe. One. Yeah, exactly. And basically I just use a WPA supplicant config script, which contains like the details for all those networks. And if you run WPA supplicant, it basically just sits in the background and tries to authenticate against one of the networks in the list. From basically, it goes through from top to bottom. So the most important, you want to put the most important ones at the top of the list, and the less important ones like the local cafe, or even sometimes I don't bother with network manager when I travel. I just add another network block in the WPA config for the campsite and just add a little comment. That's the campsite in Reykjavik, for example. And then when I notice, the password is, don't know, camping 2015 is probably not valid anymore. I just...
Okay, camping 2017.
Yeah, maybe. Or just delete the entry, yeah. And then from there, it's basically quite easy. You just use the rc.inet1.config script or config file, which configures the rc.inet1 script. And there you just tell it to start WPA supplicant on the Wi-Fi interface. You can also configure different interfaces. So what you did would be perfectly possible to configure the wired interface to be static with a static IP and use DHCP and WPA supplicant on the Wi-Fi interface. And then basically WPA supplicant just authenticates against the Wi-Fi, and then DHCP gets the IP and sets everything up. So it works quite well, even if you switch between different networks. Also, suspend to resume has never been a problem. It always resumes the connection. There is one downside. If you boot the computer and no Wi-Fi networks are available from the list, it will time out and it takes some time. It means you have to wait for like 30 seconds or something.
But you can edit the timeout. Can you? I mean, is there a way of doing that?
Yeah, never tried. Probably you can, but you don't want to set it too low because sometimes it's just slow to authenticate because maybe your router sits in another room and it's just...
It's busy,
for example, in the local cafe or something. But I usually... I mean, I don't reboot the computer that often anyway. Usually it just... suspends and resumes again and suspends again. The only reason to reboot the computer is I run out of battery and don't notice.
That's the last time my laptop got rebooted was because I put it to sleep, took it on holiday, and then didn't use it for several days.
Yeah, exactly.
And then
exactly.
Found that it was low battery when I started, and it had run out of battery. Yeah. So
I mean, if it runs low on battery while you work, it just suspends and you plug it in and it comes back. But if it runs low on battery during suspend, then it just eventually stops working.
Yeah, I think, and I don't know if you must be a way to set this up in Slackware, but the Windows laptops I've had do this weird thing: is if you have them in suspend, then they're running low on battery, they'll wake themselves up and hibernate themselves because the difference is hibernate to the disk.
Yeah.
So I think one time I was like in an airport or something, and my laptop sort of just all spontaneously just started buzzing, you know, because it was quite noisy fans and stuff.
Yeah,
and I was like, "Whoa, what's my laptop coming to life? This is I'm going through security or something, you know?" And of course it was low in battery and it was hibernating. But I've not had that with. I generally find it quite irritating because I don't want my computers turning themselves on while they're in the bag.
No, me neither.
Because the other thing is, one time it went wrong, and you open up your bag and find that it's glowing red hot.
Yeah,
because it's got no ventilation in the bag. So
yeah
so you don't. And of course, Windows had screwed it up, and yeah, it wasn't hibernating properly. It was
all right. It didn't work in the end.
Yeah, it says, "Would you like me to close this window?" So it's not exactly very useful when it's when it's closed and in your bag.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, to be fair, I've not even tried that. I mean, it's a sensible feature to have, is that you switch from suspend to hibernate.
Yeah,
that makes sense. I don't know if it works. I'll have a look.
I never bothered to set up hibernation anyway, or even try whether it works out of the box.
Yeah, well, you need to have swap space, and a lot of times these days.
But I usually still do.
You still do? Yeah, I still do, but you know, a lot of memory is so huge in laptops. Yeah. Well, at least
my swap space is generally always empty.
But yes, but it is. I mean, needed
hard drives are huge too, so it doesn't matter.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. So I know I need to have a look at that, because I do use the rc.inet1 scripts on desktop machines that I have, because there's a static IP and there's absolutely no need for anything. But for some reason, years ago, I got out of the habit of using the WPA supplicant. But that's possibly down to me being slightly lazy and not reading the documentation, and then seeing Wicked and being recommended to use that by someone. So I don't know. I don't know why. But I'll maybe go back and look at that, because I'm like you. I very rarely take my laptop to places that it's not been before. It's quite rare.
Mm.
And even when I do, if I'm staying for a week in a holiday house, like I did a few weeks ago, you know, first thing I could do is get there and edit a few lines.
Edit to file. That's what I usually do. Except for when I mean, if you travel around, for example, cycling, you go to campsite and you're on this campsite for like 12 hours.
Mm.
I don't want to edit the file every 12 hours again and then delete this again. You could do it. Still works, but...
Yeah, it's one. I think camping... Yeah, you have to I find that you have to be very efficient when you're camping, don't you?
Because you know, there is no place to charge the laptop, so you have to use as little battery as possible.
That's true. Yeah. So,
editing the WPA supplicant config file is still a waste of battery.
Yes. Precious energy. Although you must be able to, you know, thinking about it, you could. Must be something you can connect to your bike that could charge a battery that would do your phone and your laptop.
Yeah, but I've got a dynamo in the front wheel hub. So I always wanted... I think there are those things that you can connect to the dynamo and have a USB port on the other end to charge. You can't charge like a laptop, obviously, but a phone or... something small would be feasible. I think these days there are even brands of bicycle where they have built-in USB ports in the bike.
Wow.
Only charging ports. Whenever you cycle and the dynamo produces energy, during the day you don't need a light.
Yes. You can charge. When you're cycling, a human being cycling produces about 100 watts, something of that order. So it's quite a lot. It would be, you know, but of course it would.
Yeah, but usually I try to put this energy into velocity and covering distance.
That's true.
Charging things.
It makes harder. But on the plus side, you could. You know, yes, you're having to pedal harder and you exercise yourself more, but then you can justify the extra calories of another pint of beer or a plate of chips.
True. You get to your destination. Yeah, that's exactly the reason why I ride steel frame bicycles. They're heavy, so you need more calories to move them. You get to drink more beer.
Excellent. Yes. Indeed. Yes. Yes, well, there you go. Heard it first. Here. Yeah. A good reason to drink beer is to keep your laptop charged, or so you
can. Yeah, use steel frame bicycles with USB ports, and you'll get to drink a lot of beer.
Excellent. Okay, so well, you're about to leave Scotland shortly. You've got cycle to Edinburgh. So you're in Glasgow. Yeah. In Glasgow, we're talking just at my house, just outside Glasgow. I know where I live. And you're going to cycle along the canal to Edinburgh tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. And then I have to pack the bike because it goes into a bag. You have to pack. You remove pedals and remove the handlebar. I even removed the racks to fit it in the bag. But they won't allow you to check in a bike that's just like ready to ride.
I'm sure that you mentioned before it might come out in a different shape to the one.
Exactly.
that's a steel frame bike.
I still got disc brakes and those discs have to be like flat to work.
Right.
Yes. Then end up like bent after a flight. I mean, it's not that important on this flight, but on the flight from that brought me to Edinburgh was quite important.
Yes. Yeah, you wouldn't get very far with no brakes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or you might go too far. Well, I was thinking we might call this HPR episode Slackware in Scotland, and maybe one day we'll have a Slackware in Switzerland.
Episode,
perhaps.
That would be great.
That would be good. Okay, well, that was great talking to you, Benny.
Thank you.
Let's
wrap this up.
Yep, so goodbye to all our HPR listeners.
Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening to the end, for those who did.
Yes, especially Italian Arch Linux users.
Or, as I said, Italians. Italians and fruit flies.
Let's just leave it there.
All right, goodbye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.